Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are on paper 45, right at the beginning of the paper, which is old single column, page 509. And we are starting the next block of papers. We have a series of papers now on the local system, you know, the local systems, the local system level in the local universes. Remember what we're doing. We've been working our way down. We did the local universe headquarters level, then we did the constellation level, now the local system level. So you have a block of papers for each of those. With the all the universes of beings and universes of things blocks, you know, that we went through thrown in there, of course. But we're heading our way down. If when we're done with the local system block of papers, we'll get down to the actual inhabited world level, down to the actual mortal origin spheres. All right. I don't think we need to really put any more up front. Let's just jump in. Maybe just one little comment I think about it. To start off with, they're just going to give us a lot of framework of sort of bullet point like coordination into some of the basic sets of facts at the local system level. So you'll see these first sections in this paper start out with lists. We'll be stepping through lists. All right, so let's see what they've got here.
Paper for 45, the local system administration. The administrative center of Satania consists of a cluster of architectural spheres, 57 in number. Jerusalem itself, the seven major satellites, and the 49 sub-satellites. Jerusalem, the system capital, is almost 100 times the size of Urantia, although its gravity is a trifle less. Jerusalem's major satellites are the seven transition worlds, each of which is about 10 times as large as Urantia, while the seven sub-satellites of these transition spheres are just about the size of Urantia.
Okay, before we do those other two paragraphs of the preface here, let's think about that. So that should sound quite familiar. Remember when we were dealing with the worlds at the constellation level, it was the same situation, right? You had Edentia, the central world, was 100 times the diameter. The 70 major satellites were 10 times the diameter. And then all of those sub-satellites were about the size of the Earth, not the same diameter as the Earth. So they give, it's at these two levels that they give you those exact dimensions like that, and it's just interesting to note, even though the number of worlds is, much different, instead of 771 worlds like we had at the constellation level, we just have 57 here, but they're done the same size. Once you see that, you say, oh, well, I guess that makes a bit of sense. We've got, we're going to have a lot more worlds of roughly the same size at the constellation level because we've got how many local systems in a constellation? Yeah? Who knows? That was a question mark. 100 local systems in a constellation. Remember, it's mostly 100, all the different transitions. The only ones that aren't 100 are on the two ends. You have about 1,000 inhabited worlds in a local system, and you have 10 major sectors in a super universe. So there's 10 and 1,000 on the ends, the oddball numbers, and then the rest of them are hundreds. All the multiples in between. All right, so you've got 100, worlds or 100 local systems with 57 worlds each. feeding into the 771 at the constellation level.
So how do you know it's diameter and not the surface? Because if it's 100 times diameter, that means it's a lot bigger on the outside than 100 times.
Right. The surface is...
300 times, right?
No. I mean, the surface of a sphere is 4 pi radius squared. Right? So if it's 100, it's 10,000 times the surface area, right, of the Earth. Just a second before I get in. The way you know that is you go, okay, so how are they using size? You'll notice throughout the book that they use size consistently, and you can tell from the context in various places that they mean diameter when they say size. When they want to talk about volume, they'll say volume. When they want to talk about mass, they'll say mass. But if they're just talking about the size, they mean the diameter.
So the actual sphere is 10,000 times as big as the surface area.
The actual surface area, 10,000 times the surface area, yeah. Right. And, you know, there's no oceans. So that's all, you know, there's no deserts, there's no, you know, ice fields or anything like that. It's all completely used surface area. Yeah.
Wow. Yep. I was looking for that this morning and never found it. How many systems there are in a constellation?
Let's see, paper 15, isn't it, where they have the list that it starts out at the beginning? In section 2 of paper 15, you'll see them giving you that nice little table.
Okay.
Yep. And so, you know, whether or not you, you know, go through the hierarchy, you know, in terms of how many, you know, worlds, you know, in a given super universe or in, you know, in all of them, all seven super universes together, they give you those two different ways of looking at it there. You know, and you can see in the parentheses in that second list, you know, 100 systems in a constellation, 100 constellations in a universe, etc. And maybe as long as we're getting off on that tangent a little bit, remember why it is that it's not exactly 1,000 inhabited worlds in a system. Well, you know, that seems initially strange. It's like, well, there's nothing sort of just random in the universe of universes. This is all precisely patterned. Every one of the numbers is exactly a multiple of 10. Why would that not be exactly a multiple of 10? Because you get an exact multiple of 10 of having exactly 7 trillion inhabited worlds relative to the installation, you know, the sort of the records of those on the Isle of Paradise, because you have to add up all of the worlds, not just the ones that evolve into a sphere, like ours, but the ones that were made. You know, if you add up all of the evolutionary inhabited worlds plus all of the architectural spheres, you get exactly 7 trillion. You know, that, so the very, you know, when you think about like a local system, it has roughly 1,000 inhabited worlds plus always 57. Right? And so that variation also of why it is that, you know, you have these precise numbers on every level, but in the local system, you have in the neighborhood, you know, including the architectural worlds, you know, 1,000. That variation, including the architectural worlds, that reflects the variation from Havona world to Havona world. You know, one Havona world is the pattern for one local system, you know, in a given super universe. You know, one Havona world is a pattern for 7 local systems, one in each super universe. But you know, if you think about our super universe, there's one Havona world attached to our local system. There's a different Havona World attached to one of the neighboring local systems, and those Havona Worlds are completely different from each other. You know, that differential between those two worlds is manifest in the variation of how many worlds, when all is said and done, there is going to be in a local system. And when all is said and done, every world is like an architectural world. Eventually, you know, the fully settled, deep, enlightened life, Urantia, is going to be just as precisely, eternally defined as an architectural world. Okay?
Don't they say somewhere that once you, the world's in enlightened life, it's not counted anymore? I'm trying to remember exactly what they say.
It will get to that, okay. Rather than going on, you know, that, when we get to the beginning of that paper, that's when we start out on the inhabited worlds, yeah. Okay. We'll sort out that very confusing passage. but you see that's, you know, that, you know, just keep that in mind, that that whole power personality synthesis, that, you know, literally to properly express the pattern of a given Havona world, the number of inhabited spheres, when all is said and done in a local system, is required to vary in order to match up with that pattern. You can't match up with that very unique variation of pattern in the central universe worlds by having a fixed number of inhabited worlds in each local system. That's what it's telling you between the lines. Now, the one little thing that everyone always ponders in there, you know, is when they tell you these statements that these architectural worlds all have a gravity that's roughly the same as ours. You know, whether or not it's 100 times the diameter or 10 times the diameter or, you know, roughly the same diameter. See, although its gravity is a trifle less. Okay? So that's just kind of, you know, of reminding you that when we get to the inhabited worlds, you'll find that our world is kind of in the middle in almost every way you can think of, all the different ways that worlds vary and mortals vary. We're a very center of the bell curve sort of a world. So not surprisingly, the gravity in these architectural worlds where all these different variations feed in is going to be close to the middle. You've got worlds that have a lot greater gravity, worlds that have a lot lower gravity, but they're all going to feed into worlds where it's the best compromise for everyone. You know, a world that's kind of in the middle of the distribution from relative to where people were coming from. So that too reminds you, even though everyone is getting a Urantia body, and if the mortals on their world are all quite short relative to us, or the mortals on their world are all quite tall relative to us because the gravity is greater or less respectively. Certainly don't immediately think that they're going to copy that variation in height that directly when they make Urantia bodies for all these beings, but there's more to material gravity than just the simple immediate Newtonian sort of linear gravity and beings being taller or shorter, you know, seeming, you know, making sense. Urantia substance has physical energy in it. It's affected by material gravity. And so when they say you're going to pick up where you left off, that's part of it. That in ways that we don't fully understand, your mind is going to be subject to a similar gravitational environment to what it is on your beginning world, at least within, you know, being the center of the bell curve relative to the spectrum of variations. And so all those things are, you know, are in play as you feed into the local system level, where they're balancing all of these variations in the roughly 1,000 worlds. Oh, and then back to the main point. The the curiosity of, okay, how is it that something could be 100 times the diameter and have roughly the same gravity? I was like, well, does that mean these architectural spheres are hollow? Does it mean that they're some sort of like honeycomb sort of structure? You know, when they're built, you know, how does this work? You know, and what way do you get the density, you know, down low enough that the gravity, you know, the mean density down low enough that the gravity could be about the same? Well, you know, remember, you're just speculating. You can't immediately reject either of those possibilities that I just put forward. However, one very straightforward solution is, remember, there are master physical controllers, right, that are going to always be on those spheres. We'll read in a little bit, they have all kinds of things that they have to maintain constantly. You know, so it's not like they can go off on a vacation somewhere because the lights will go out, right? So, you know, it may just be that they add enough anti-gravity by their presence to make what normally would be a very heavy gravity environment roughly the same as the Earth. So it may have nothing to do with really with the how the mass is structured in the world itself. It may just be their anti-gravity presence negating part of the centering influence there. You know, it's just on an ongoing basis, every nanosecond of every day. Just like they do in our solar system. You know, we've been carefully studying the solar system for a lot of years now, watching the planets, and we haven't seen the slightest little variation in what appears to be the sun's gravitational pull on our planet or any of the other planets. But the revelators tell you there's nothing natural about the amount of gravity that the Earth feels. The master physical controllers are significantly diminishing the amount of gravity that we would feel from the sun by their anti-gravity presence. You know, and that modification is staying exactly the same to as many decimal places as we can measure, which is a lot of decimal places. Okay? So it's a very, very precise presence that they can maintain. You get to thinking that they must not have eyelids, because you wouldn't want them to even be blinking, or that would change the 13th decimal place or something, right? So they must be a very, very, constant sort of a presence being, because their eyelids are part of their nature. I mean, if you quote unquote, if you know what I mean there, they can't be, having little twitches or anything going on in their body. Right? It's got to be a very, very precise system that is their body that manifests that presence. Okay, so that might just be the simple answer, is it's just the anti-gravity presence. But we'll find out when we get there. Who knows? Yeah. I mean, you can think, it's like, well, would they really need it to be completely solid? Maybe it could be some sort of a honeycomb structure. I don't know. But anyway. All right, let's see. Is there... maybe just, commenting. You notice here we, unlike when we at the super at the local universe headquarters level, or at the constellation level, where you had both the 7-fold pattern and the 10-fold pattern, expressed in various ways. You'd have 70 major satellites. So you have 7 × 10, and you have 7 worlds around, or 10 worlds around, or whatever. Notice here, it's all 7s. Right? So it's, and even more definitively than, having 6 sub-satellites and then the center one, and together you have 7. I mean, here you literally have 7 sub-satellites and 7 primary satellites. So it's very definitively 7-fold, the expression here. You don't have any sort of literal expression of the tenfold forms of physical energy being expressed here, which is kind of an interesting thing, because remember, at the local system level, it's the individuality level, individuality, associativity, unity. And so your first thought might be that you would see a lot of tens when you're dealing with the individuality, but you don't. You're not at the level yet where the, like for us, for the ascension scheme, where the ascension scheme is sort of forcing you to have to deal with that variation of the tenfoldness. You're not trying to really get into the complexities of the cosmos yet. What you're trying to do at the local system level is, it's about the fundamental thing for you as an ascender, the individuality, is that we're trying to get you individuated.
We're primers.
Right? You know, so it's you becoming individuated in a sevenfold context. And that's it. And then, but once you're individuated and you go up to the constellation level, then you're going to start to deal with all the great complexities. Okay, all these different things that you can now have the contrast of this and the contrast of that and all this, right? So it's a, you know, there's just a few worlds. It's kind of just a basic sevenfold expression, and you the individual, trying to get fully individuated as a Mirancha being. All right, then they give you a little. Oh, yep.
Question in the webinar.
Yep.
From John, Chris, what are the master physical controllers doing, or differentiating or identifying when they exert anti-gravity influence? I think they're identifying more with the space between particles rather than the particles themselves.
Okay, so the question is about, you know, how is this working with the anti-gravity influence? Remember, when you're talking about them having anti-gravity influence, it's not relative gravity. It's not linear gravity. So it has nothing to do with separations between two objects, like we think of like Newtonian gravity, where you figure out how much gravity is there by taking the product of the two masses. Okay? This is anti-gravity in the absolute gravity sense, in just the sense of a single mass. A single mass as an inward influence, right? If you have a mass, we've noticed phenomenologically, there's this tendency for things to go toward it. We call that phenomenon gravity, right? I lift up this cup and drop it. It has a tendency to go towards the center of this big ball we're standing on, right? There's this inward influence in the environment we're in. The greater the mass of that you're talking about, the greater that inward influence. So just not the relationship between two masses, but just the single mass itself, how much inwardness there is. The sun is a certain mass, but the revelators tell you that inwardness phenomenon that you feel, the gravity of the sun that you experience, is less than it would be if you were exposed to the inward phenomenon of that, how much mass is actually there. They are, you know, so you're effectively not negating the gravity in the Newtonian linear gravity sense. You're negating the amount of mass that is effective. The sun is less effective as a gravitating, you know, as an inward phenomenon because of their presence. You know, so they add some outwardness and some outward motion to the inward motion that is that gravitational phenomenon. You know, and then everything is then relative to that. Right? So, the gravitational influence of the mass of my body is less because of their anti-gravity presence. They are making every mass have less of an influence. Now, the reason that we don't pick up on that is because gravity is such a tiny thing, you know, that you can't pick up on the fact that I, you know, the gravitational influence of me is being modified a little bit. Right? You know, because, you know, and another thing too, I mean, you know, we can, there's other ways besides gravity to figure out how much mass is in my body. You know, you can, you know, if it's a small enough mass, you can actually get a pretty good estimate of how many molecules are there, and you just, you know, multiply it by the mass of each molecule, you know, and you can get the total mass. I mean, we can't count the number of molecules in the sun and, you know, and add it all up, you know, and go, wait a minute, I get a mass that's more than the gravity we feel, right? You know, you theoretically could do it for masses our size that you can total up in different ways, but the gravity is so minuscule, you know, that you can't measure that tiny difference, you know, between how much attracting power I have compared to what I would have if their anti-gravity presence wasn't here.
So that's why water having greater mass than rocks or dirt or anything has a tendency to go into the center, you know, seek its own level, I guess, which constantly seems to get through stuff.
Well, I mean, you know, all of the relativity, you know, gravity things, the Newtonian gravity that we know about, you know, that all then works just fine in its relative way. See, they're just, you know, what they're doing, rather than changing the relative gravity that we experience, they're just, it's like turning the knob on the scale so that, you know, when you step on the scale, you know, you aren't starting at zero. But they don't change how far the ticks are apart, you know, on the you know, on the scale. The distance you know, between 2 pounds and 3 pounds is still the same, right? But you're starting at 1 pound instead of zero, right? See, it's changing the absolute level rather than changing any relativity, you know, aspect of it. All right, we're fine now? Okay, all right, so let's keep going here.
Two, the seven mansion worlds are the seven sub-satellites of transition world number one. Three, this entire system of 57 architectural worlds is independently lighted, heated, watered, and energized by the coordination of the Satania Power Center and the Master Physical Controllers in accordance with the established technique of the physical organization and arrangement of these specially created spheres. They are also physically cared for and otherwise maintained by the native Spirangia.
Okay, so we have the Spirangia, you know, here again. Remember when we mentioned them, they're at every level. All these are literal material spheres. When you go to heaven, you don't go to some non-material plane or, you know, quote-unquote or something, non-material domain. It's all material. There's all kinds of things that just have to be maintained, and the Spirangia do that. Here's, you know, like I just mentioned, we were just about to read, you have to have all of these master physical controllers present and doing very precise things every nanosecond because it's independently lighted, heated, watered, and energized. Right? None of that's just sort of happens and is whatever the heck it is because of plate tectonics or something, right?
There's a lot of those
right?
guys.
Right, so, I mean, so, see, you put two and two together. They're all there doing all these things all the time already. So, all they have to do is just have a certain anti-gravity setting in the back of their mind that is just a drone tone because they're there. You know, and the gravity is what it is then. Right? And then they're messing with the details of, you know, it's not like the lighting and heating and stuff never change. They, you know, like they'll talk about that varies, you know, so there's kind of a diurnal cycle and this sort of stuff, right? But, you know, it seems like it's probably, you know, that's what's going on. So the master physical controllers are, you know, are handling the gravity too. Now, the funny thing about this little preface is that it's three paragraphs. there's that tiny little single short sentence paragraph stuck in the middle there, which is reminding you that you're getting close to what you've been waiting for since you started reading the foreword here in paper 45. It's like, what about me? What about where I live? Aren't you ever going to talk about me? By this time, you know that there's this whole bit of the seven mansion worlds, and that's where you're going next. See, so they set aside just one little paragraph just for you. The seven mansion worlds are the seven sub-satellites of the transition world number one. It's like, I finally know where they are. Right? See? point of extreme interest. Where are you going next? It's like, okay, yeah, constellation levels and blah, 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 blah. I mean, it's not very immediately interesting to us because it's so abstract, right? But to actually finally worked your way in the universe of universes down through all of this mind-numbing complexity, finally you can point, in your mind's eye to where you're going. You're going to go to those sub-satellites around the first of the primary satellites of our local system headquarters. That's where you're going next. All right. That should start to kind of get your interest peaked.
Chris?
Yep.
Briefly, an obvious question. But the master physical controllers obviously are very much stationary. They don't move around.
Master physical controllers are not stationary like the power centers are.
Okay.
Power centers are very anchored sort of beings. Remember, we'll get to that eventually. We've got one supreme power center in our local system. He's not on Gerasim. He's on that dark island of space that's not too far from Gerasim. But he's just planted there and sits there. The master physical controllers, are mobile and move about and do things. But when you think about the mechanical controllers, that would be the, your first guess about the anti-gravity thing. Their presence is huge.
And they're stationary?
No. No, they move about. But see, if their presence is huge, okay, just kind of picture a 3-foot diameter circle, and put a little grain of rice in the middle of it. Okay, how much can that the center of that 3-foot diameter circle move about and have the grain of rice still be completely inside of it, right? So if they if they're laying out a very big presence, like they're in our solar system, they've got a presence that's the size of the solar system, bigger than, they have that cocoon of space that they maintain, their presence, all the planets are within it, and they aren't like floating out in space somewhere, they have to stand on a world,
you've got these
interesting questions, do you get that presence for the whole local system? Do they just stand on the two inhabited worlds in our solar system? And that does it? Or, they never really explain kind of how, how this works, but that seems like what you're supposed to conclude. The fact that we have two inhabited worlds, makes you wonder if there might be a little bit of variation of this anti-gravity, in this cocoon of space. Maybe the inner part of the solar system is a little bit different in terms of the gravity than the outer parts. And I've talked about that. We have some evidence from watching these satellites, the Pioneers and the Voyagers, going way out, that maybe there is some sort of a variation, in how much gravitational pull they up from the sun they feel. Like somehow the gravity's changed. So there may be kind of two regions because we have two inhabited worlds.
Anybody ever figured out where that other one is?
Well, the likely place is immediately on the outside of the Kuiper Belt, in between Pluto and Eris.
Another inhabited world?
Yeah.
Not getting much sunlight, though, right?
It is, yeah, well, if you're a non-breather world, you don't need any sunlight.
That's where that ship is headed.
It's a big, big place out there. So, yeah, the New Horizons spacecraft might be here, and you know the other inhabited world's on the other side of the solar system. So, you know, it's not like it's going to fly
it's
by
still
it.
Still in the solar system.
Yeah, it's still in the solar. You know, it just went by Pluto. You know.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And it'll take it a long time before it gets past the Kuiper Cliff, the outer margin of the Kuiper Belt.
Which is still in the solar system.
Which is still in the solar system, yeah.
And they wouldn't let it fly by anyway.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's all right. And even if it did, they wouldn't see it because, you know, there's a reason why we haven't found this planet. I mean, they're not allowing us to see it right now.
It doesn't reflect photons.
It doesn't reflect the sunlight. They're preventing the sunlight from reflecting off of it, or we'd see it. But we see its obvious gravitational influence. The distribution of those objects in the Kuiper Belt it doesn't tail off on both sides. It does the thing like Saturn's rings, caused by the little shepherd moons. It create a sharp edge to the Saturn's rings. Something quite large is obviously going around just outside that belt and keeping those objects in the Kuiper Belt from drifting out and creating fuzzy boundaries on both sides.
Think it could have come from Lomatia?
No, it's one of the 12.
Oh, but think it could have come when
it's the 11th planet.
It was when we were pulled off, you know, when the, what was the name of the thing?
The Angana system.
Yeah, I guess. I think it could have come from there.
No, the three objects from the Angana system. Again, you're getting me way off track here. But the three objects from the Angana system, but I love to get off track. If you look at the solar system, the way you find those three objects that they tell you we captured is to look for three obvious retrograde facts in the solar system. Okay.
One of them's close.
The three obvious facts is one of those objects obviously hit Venus and combined with it. That's why Venus rotates on its axis retrograde. Okay. It got smacked and that's why it's bigger than you'd expect it to be.
Okay.
It absorbed one of those. The other object you know that got hit is Uranus, which is tipped on its side. It obviously got smacked by something, right? And so that's obviously where another one of those went. It hit Uranus. And then Neptune, you'd expect it to have a whole bunch of moons. But instead, it really just has one big moon, Triton,
and it's
orbiting Neptune in a retrograde fashion. That's the third object. That's actually one of those three objects we captured. We can still see one of those three objects. It's Triton. It was one of those three objects, that big moon of Neptune. And most likely, some of the larger objects that we see out there beyond Neptune are the moons that it used to have. When it captured Triton, those other moons got flung out of orbit. So, and then the other thing, it appears that Triton probably hit Pluto before it got captured by Neptune, and that's why Pluto is shattered into two big objects and some smaller stuff. And Triton even looks like it smacked something, because a big part of its surface has been totally redone. Right, it's probably the part that smacked Pluto as it went by and broke Pluto in half, and then it got captured by Neptune. So
it's the Death Star.
So that's most, it says we captured three objects, and you go, well, if I can find retrograde in the solar system, that would indicate one of those objects, and you count how many significant retrograde phenomena, you have three. Mm-hmm. Ta-da! It's pretty straightforward. All right, let's look at those primary satellites. The sub-satellites are really not described to us in any detail except for the seven Mansion Worlds. So basically, when they talk about the local system, they talk about the seven primaries And then the seven sub-satellites of the first one, the seven mansion worlds, and the rest of it is just sort of, you know, you'll see, is just a quick little passing comment. We don't get much detail at all on the other sub-satellites.
Because it has nothing to do with us.
Because they really don't have anything, to do with us, yeah. All right.
One, transition cultural worlds. One, the seven major worlds swinging around Jerusalem are generally known as the transition cultural spheres. Their rulers are designated from time to time by the Jerusalem Supreme Executive Council. These spheres are numbered and named as follows.
Before you do that, the one thing that, why on earth the word transitional? Did that strike you? I mean, doesn't that seem like a very strange, designation? Why are these, especially when they really don't have a lot to do with us? So it's not, you can't say it's just our transition. Why is this, and basically, why is the whole local system set of worlds being called a transitional place? What makes this transitional? Why is this fundamentally, in a local universe sense, a transitional domain?
Moving through.
Maybe it's the comings, not the goings.
Well, what did we just read about? What was the previous block of papers about?
Constellation
level. Which they said, that's the fundamental Marantia domain, right? Yeah. At the constellation level is when you're fully doing the Marantia thing. When you're on the local, when you're on your mortal origin worlds, what are you fundamentally doing here? Are you doing the spirit thing here? Are you doing the Marantia thing here? What are you doing here?
The animal experience.
Material thing, right? Right. We've got three substances, right? That you could have, that your body could be made out of, so that your whole kind of basic nature and your interaction with the environment is about one of those substances. If I'm a spirit being, I'm interacting with the spirit stuff in the environment. If I'm a Marantia being, first I'm interacting with the Marantia stuff in the environment. If I'm a material being, first I'm interacting with the material stuff in the environment, right? See, so that's why it's fundamentally the transitional domain. It's in between the Marantia domain, the constellation level, and the material domain, the inhabited worlds, right? That's what's transitional about it. And it doesn't matter if you're not an ascending being, if you're just the seraphim or the brilliant evening stars or whatever the heck you are, if you're functioning at the local system headquarters, you're involved in a ministry that's transitional. Transitional, whether you're going top down or bottom up, however you're looking at it, it's in between the center of the Marantia stuff and the center of the material stuff. Okay, that's why it's transitional culture. Transitional between a material culture and a Marantia culture. Okay? Either way, Marantia to material or material to Marantia. Right? It's a transitional cultural domain. Okay.
Number one, the Finaliter world. This is the headquarters of the Finaliter core of the local system and is surrounded by the receiving worlds, the seven mansion worlds, dedicated so fully to the scheme of mortal ascension. The Finaliter world is accessible to the inhabitants of all seven mansion worlds. Transport seraphim carry ascending personalities back and forth on these pilgrimages, which are designed to cultivate their faith in the ultimate destiny of transition mortals. Although the Finaliters and their structures are not ordinarily perceptible to Marantia vision, you will be more than thrilled from time to time when the energy transformers and the Marantia power supervisors enable you momentarily to glimpse these high spirit personalities who have actually completed the paradise ascension and who have returned to the very worlds where you are beginning this long journey as the pledge of assurance that you may and can complete the stupendous undertaking. All Mansion World sojourners go to the Finaliter Sphere at least once a year for these assemblies of Finaliter visualization.
Okay, all kinds of fun stuff there. Maybe just kind of start out with picturing yourself going to the finaliter world without the help of the kind of master physical controllers that are called energy transformers. So they're going to do some sort of energy transformation thing, along with the Marantia power supervisors, because you're a Marantia being, and so they're going to make this accessible, give you kind of a Marantia external world to experience as a Marantia individual. But without that, you go there, well, there's going to be some things that you'll see, but the real significant stuff that you want to see is invisible. All the finaliters and all of their structures, all their buildings, everything will be invisible to you. They're made out of stuff that you can't see. Because these are, and they can see you completely, but you can't even remotely see them or their things. Again, remember, it's not just beings, it's things and beings. There's a power personality synthesis always, the higher you go especially. So, there's a whole environment there of things and beings, that is invisible. And like I said, it's probably not like you go there and it's just a featureless ball as far as the eye can see in every direction, okay? But, you're not going to see any more than, there could be some incredibly magnificent, gigantic spirit building right in front of me, that this material building is built in the midst of, and we couldn't see it or feel it or anything. We don't see any of these other substances. Our senses don't pick them up. And humans have always had the tendency to think, well, if I don't sense anything in the external world, it isn't there. It's like it couldn't be farther from the truth. You can almost sense nothing of the external world. What you think is a complete assessment of your external world is so far from that. I mean, everything that's worth seeing on this planet, you can't see, basically.
Beautiful sunset tonight.
Right. And we all say, oh, no, what I see is beautiful. Well, yes and no. As we talked about, we went to the celestial artisans, right? Beauty is relative. It's as beautiful as our beauty recognition is capable of experiencing right now. But when we actually see beauty at a higher level, a sunset will, or a majestic mountain range will drift into, that won't trigger emotions like it does for you now. That's why you don't need sunsets or mountain ranges on the architectural worlds. See, I mean, think about it. If those were indispensable to you having rich experience, they would be there. But there are no sunsets, and there are no mountain ranges, and there are no seascapes, and there all the things that we think, there are no Grand Canyons, there are no, all the things that we think are materially beautiful, are beautiful about the environment. None of those things are there, right? Because they, in a bigger sense, they aren't beautiful. Beauty is something so much more than we can imagine. Those are just dim shadows of beauty. So dim that to those on high, they look like black spots. And we'd never think that a black spot was beautiful. That's what they're trying to get us to recognize. That's how dimly we see right now. It's like, wait till you begin to experience something that's really beautiful. You'll never have an interest. It's like, oh, if only I could see a sunset again. You'll just, it's like, that will not, you won't be pining for any of these things. That's why they're not there. They don't torture you there by taking away your beautiful things. You won't be yearning for them anymore. Remember how we talked about, you'll have a hard time not just wanting to veg out and stare at a single building for all eternity. The first place you live, you'll just want to just, it's like, I don't care about anything else. I just want to stare at this door for the rest of eternity. This is so incredible. I can't even begin to wrap my mind around it. I mean, that's what, so you won't pine for sunsets or Grand Canyon vistas or, man.
So is this
they do
a
touch
grotesque
you.
Thing again?
Again, see, in factual terms, it's quote-unquote grotesque because it's just so relatively dark to genuine light.
But don't not look at
them. But the reason we call them beautiful, why do we call them beautiful? Because that's false? No. It's in truth, it's beautiful. It's the most downstepped expression of beauty that exists. Right? Just like we're the most downstepped expression of a sensile phenomenon that exists. Yeah. It's all right. In truth, it's beautiful. If you follow the beauty of a sunset or a Grand Canyon vista upward, you will recognize how it's a downstepped expression of something that's, you know, really beautiful on high, but a very, very downstepped expression. In a more objective perspective, in fact, you know, it's not beautiful, but in truth, it's beautiful. Just like right now, in fact, you're not, you know, anything that would be emblazoned with the word good. You know, when celestials look at you, they don't think, "Wow, now that is the poster child for goodness." You know, we don't need to look any further. No, they don't see you as some profound actuality that needs to have some eternal label on it. They minister to you because of your potential. You have value because of your potential, not of your actuality. Your actuality of recognizing that which is true, beautiful, or good, you know, or embodying what's true, beautiful, and good, that's not why you're lovingly ministered, because of what you are. It's because of what you're becoming. They minister to you for your potential. Right? And that should make you be more delighted about the love that you've received, the ministration you receive, than before. Right? I mean, a mother certainly can understand this. A lot of times when a baby comes out of the womb, beautiful's not the first word that pops into your head. Yeah, it's not even, you know, a lot of times it's not even close to being very symmetric yet. You know, it's the various body parts are way out of whack. They don't really go together, and the head may have gotten really squashed on the way out, and it's got very black hair all over its face or something that hasn't fallen off yet or something, you know, something that only a mother could love, you know, we say, right? So, I mean, we understand that's what the celestials see. That very lump and little newborn, you know, that doesn't look like Adamic perfection of symmetry yet, right? That's what they see. Right? But because that little newborn doesn't look like your idealization of an Adamic child, do you not love it? Do you not tenderly care for it? Right? You know, so,
and you better say how beautiful.
That's the way it works. You know, that's all we're talking about. We understand this, right? You love it because you know it has value because of what it's becoming, not of what it is. Right? That's why there's no difference between a single-celled human and a 100-trillion-year-old human. They have the exact same value, what they're becoming. Neither of them have any value in and of themselves. The difference between a single-celled human and a 100-trillion-year-old human relative to eternity is a difference of no consequence. I mean, if I take eternity minus 100 trillion or eternity, you still have eternity. There's no difference, right? You have no value ever for what you are. You always have fundamentally value because of what you're becoming. When you're an absentite being, in the fourth outer space level, you know, in the fourth absentite age, you still will have value really only because of what you're becoming, not because of what you are. There's always beauty that you can't even consciousize yet. And so, in relative terms, you're still grotesque. See, this is what you have to get, you know, just you have to recognize.
One of the very few compliments that they give us there's a tension between what's potential and what's actualized.
Yeah.
What's good and truth versus what's good and fact, yeah. there's a tension in there, and in right. that tension, there's a potential for humor.
Yeah.
And when someone's without humor, it's because they're only look, they only see one thing. Mm-hmm. They don't see the.
Yeah.
They don't take any pleasure in the differential. It's right. all.
Right.
And it can be either one.
And that humor of the contrast between what you are and what you could be or what you're becoming, that's what the humorist on high always play up. I mean, the reversion directors are trying to get you to chuckle about yourself, you know, when they actually get you to contrast how two things that are in truth are beautiful, to get you to look at the facts and compare them factually. You know, and all you can do is laugh when you actually look at it. Oh, my goodness. Oh, yeah. Right. Yeah. And how that helps with your humility, you know, and your love of grace. I mean, the grace that allows you to be that lumpen to begin with and still loved as if you were the only being in the universe. I mean, that's cool.
But you know, when I think back at pictures of myself when I was a teenager, and I thought I looked pretty reasonable back then.
Pretty rocking, yeah.
Yeah. Look back at those pictures, and that's funny. That is funny.
Right. Oh. Right.
That's why you keep your high school yearbook, so you can look at that stuff. Oh. Yeah.
Right.
That's humor.
See, and again, it's like, you know, the revelation isn't telling you anything that we don't already know. They're just reminding you that what you can experience even in a short life in terms of that differential, that just goes on forever. Yeah. When you're on the constellation level and you look at what kind of clothes you were wearing back on the local system level, it'll be just like looking back at the clothes you wore in junior high. You know? You know, and you'll just chuckle, you know, at how immature you were. And it just goes on like that forever. When you're on the first circle of Avona and you look back at yourself when you were on the second circle of Avona, you know, you'll just shake your head and chuckle. how immature you were. You know, when all you'd done is just transcended God the sevenfold, you know, and you'd hardly even gotten started yet.
Broken.
Right? Broken. It's all relative.
So why do rebels not, you know, see these finalers and, you know, say, hey, gee, these guys did it there and came all the way back?
Well, remember, they talk about that. When we get to reading about the rebellion, they speak to that issue. How did Lucifer handle the finaliters? You know, their existence. Okay, so this is like the meat of it, so we need to spend a little time on this. You can see it's a great big paragraph here. So let's just, a couple other things that are in there. You know, again, they mentioned, you know, here's where you've got the mansion worlds. We'll get to it eventually. Does anyone remember, relative to the mansion worlds, what's on the finaliter world that's related to your beginning mansion world experience? Yeah, the probationary nursery. Remember, the seven mansion worlds are surrounding a world where the probationary nursery is. So those finaliters are the caretakers of the salvaged children of the Father as well. And we'll get to that, you know, like I said, as we go on here with the local system level. Now, one of the things that transport seraphim, carry ascending personalities back and forth on these pilgrimages.
Yeah, I love that.
Okay, so that just really kind of blows up your whole science fiction picture, right? I mean, if you think about, you know, say Star Trek, okay? I mean, in Star Trek, if they were going to go from a facility on the Earth to a facility on the Moon, I mean, they would just hop in a shuttlecraft and zip over. Notice, see how different there are. You know, you think, well, I mean, these, you know, the technology they have obviously is beyond our wildest dreams, but you don't have some sort of a shuttlecraft or, you know, transport vehicle. No, you have to go through the whole in seraphiming routine and stuff. See, isn't that an interesting thing? You know, so these are literal material worlds in all this, but it's not a sci-fi environment like we think. Where certainly, you know, that would be the easier way, you would think, to be getting people between all of these 57 worlds.
Maybe they're far apart.
That could apply only to ascending personalities and not other.
No.
Well, Chris, I think it's pretty sci-fi to jump in an angle and.
Yeah, that's what I was going to get. See, it's a different kind of a sci-fi.
It's not mechanical, but it doesn't make any sense why they would.
Right. See that's what you just teed it up. That's what I was going to get you to think about. You know, our science fiction, think about how materially oriented it is, see? We our fundamental assumption is that the universe is just a cold, mindless collection of matter with a few scattered blobs of protoplasm playing around in it.
Except you have Q.
And so our science fiction starts with, with that material assumption. No, the universe is mind-made and personality-managed. Instead of starting with, it's a mindless collection of matter, start with, it's an incomprehensible collection of beings, of personalities. And then, oh, by the way, they do need a place to stand. And so there's matter for them to stand on. So if that's your starting point, what kind of a science fiction do you develop? If you start with personalities rather than with matter. Right? See, so that's what's between the lines there. Just how unimaginative we are right now relative to the reality of the universe. We think so materialistically, so simple-mindedly, that even when we get very fanciful and have science fiction and whatnot, it's all just about matter. Okay? And so, everything we have, all of our imaginings about religion are about matter. Right? Jesus would just pound his head against the wall trying to get his apostles to think about something besides matter. It didn't matter how many times he said he's your spiritual father, they heard material father. Guy that plays on the planet in burning bushes and stuff. He wants you to pray to him for material things. And he gives you material things. That it's all about material things. Oh God, give me a science fiction material experience. Especially a Star Trek one, like Next Generation one, where everything is rosy and we are just so materialistic. The whole prayer life has no relationship to matter. Any thought of a prayer life being related to matter is utterly false. And that's what the Revelation teaches you.
Remember when they say pray for values? That's code for
spirit substance things. Right.
Oh, I thought that was
right.
Walmart value.
Right. And just that, the fact that we completely corrupt the word value and use it for matter. See?
Exactly.
So that Walmart has value. Right. No, the things at Walmart, that's about worth.
Yeah.
Right? That's about worth.
Right.
When you take value and you bring it into relationship to matter, that's why you have the word worth. Worth is about the relationship to matter. Value is a spirit word. Right? So again, because it's just a reminder, the Re-Entry Book teaches you what words are spirit words. And just go to the dictionary or listen to common parlance. And notice that all those spirit words are used for material things. That's how materialistic we are. Right? We use spirit words for material things. That's how far we are away from anything that is really genuine. In fact, all we've got is the grace of truth to hang our hats on. That's it. If you're looking to hang your hat on any fact that you are right now, it's not there. Truth is the only thing that keeps you in relationship to the universe, not fact. As a mere fact, if you were to choose iniquity right now, it would be as if you had never been born. As a fact, you have no impact, right? All right, so there's all kinds of things. If you reflect on this, just those little bits of Just to go, it's like, really? To go from one of the mansion worlds to the world that that mansion world is orbiting? I've got to do a transport seraphim? I can't just get on shuttlecraft number 3 or something? What?
Yeah.
See?
How much distance are we talking about? How long is the trip?
Well, it's not going to be any great, you know. All you have, to, you know, just you know, enough space to have 7 worlds going around. You know, you wouldn't expect it to probably be as close as the moon is to the Earth, but not much further. I mean, it's, you know, 7 worlds in orbit about a central world, right? Big, it's not very far.
Big ones.
Right?
Big world.
You know, I mean, you know, think of the moon system of Jupiter. You know, that's a big moon. You know, I mean, only has the, you know, 4 Galilean moons that are close. But, you know, the whole set of moons, just kind of think about that big space that Jupiter sort of dominates gravitationally. Right? I mean, Jupiter's the size of one of these transitional worlds. You know, that shows you the basic gravitational influence of a world, you know, that size. I mean, of course, but the gravity is only same as, you know, our planet. But, you know, just to give you a little sense of, just imagine putting 7 great big satellites, you know, around Jupiter. You know?
So they actually have to be a little closer than what they would for Jupiter, since there's less gravity.
Again, you know, all of that is, you know, the master physical controllers are maintaining all the orbits and everything, too. You know, nothing is sort of just naturally orbiting. And it's a completely artificial system.
Maybe that's why you have to seraphim.
You're not going to naturally get 7 planets to be on the same, you know, path going around, you know, a world, you know, in a string of pearls fashion, right? You know, so that little choo-choo train of 7 worlds going around, I mean, that's just very artificial, but stable. You know, just little shades of having, you know, millions of worlds going around on a circuit of Vavona, all in a string of pearls fashion, you know. Okay. Yeah, it's hard to get there without permission. And that's a very good point. You know, that whole idea of illegal immigrants, they're going to talk about that. You know, see, the fact that you can't just like steal away on a shuttlecraft, you know, or whatever, and, you know, get crawl in the wheel well of the plane or whatever, you know.
Buy a ticket.
You know, stow away in the, you know, the bowels of the ship, get across the Atlantic or whatever. No, I mean, you know, it's an elaborate affair to get in seraphim. You know, it takes all of those master physical controllers to launch that seraphim off the world and all this, you know, and there's just one person on board, you know, you can't get in a corner of anything, right? So, I just, there's no opportunity for any sort of illegal, quote unquote, unsanctioned activity like that. Right? That's an important thing to think about.
Are we just assuming that they're revolving around?
No, I mean, they tell you everything is in motion around. And just physically, it has to be. I mean, you know, if they weren't in orbit, they'd fall. Right? I mean, it's not like the central world has no inwardness. You know, if I imagine a marble placed nearby to transition world number 1, that marble will fall through space and hit the surface of that world just like a meteor does. Right? It's all the normal gravitational thing. So, I mean, the only reason they stay, you know, they don't fall in and, you know, collect with the central object is because they're in orbit. You know, so they are definitely in orbit. It's just it's a managed orbit. It isn't just whatever the heck, the evolutionary process produced. Right? And so they aren't some ellipse. They're all nice circles and, right? Yeah. Okay. Let's see.
What touches me most on here is this thing about being able to, you know, envision the finaliters at some point, you know, right then in your very first trip there in the very first world.
Yep.
That touched my heart. In other words, it kind of said, oh man, it made me feel like, you know, the fact that you can see or get some glimpse of this thing that these beings that you're going to eventually, you know, trillions or billions of years later get to.
Yeah.
Was, you know, that was kind of cool to me. I mean, that really said, gee, I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, and that's what we were just going to get to. Right, so notice that there's something that you started to feel in the second half of this paragraph.
Yeah,
it's got all of this kind of power, you know, issues, and then there's the personal issues combined together in the one paragraph. You know, so you kind of just teed it up. See where I was going next. To notice how it goes from all of this stuff we've been talking about, which is all kind of scientific and technical and whatnot, and then it says, transport serve and carry ascending personalities back and forth to these assemblages, comma, which are designed to cultivate their faith. See, right in the middle of the paragraph, it transitions. You go all the way from thinking about shuttlecraft, you know, and why not, to faith. Faith in the ultimate destiny of transition mortals. You know, so again, remember that, like I was saying, it's always the case that you can literally see less than sort of you need to recognize exists. There's always a place for faith. Right? When you're on the first mansion world, you won't need the beginning faith that you need here, but you'll need a higher level of faith. And then when you're on the second mansion world, you won't need the kind of faith that you needed on the first mansion world, but you'll need a higher kind of faith, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That the faith that you need right now will be matured into a trust that your life on the first mansion world will be based on. And your faith will be reaching to the next stage. But then you'll mature that faith into trust, and you'll live upon that trust at the next stage, and your faith will be reaching to the next stage. Right? Faith is the upward grasp. Right? It's not meant for where you're at right now. Where you're at right now is you're supposed to be standing on trust and reaching up to faith, not grasping to try to somehow stay standing where you are with faith, constantly trying to antidote fear with faith. That's not what faith was designed for. You're supposed to have trust. We were talking about that. Fear not, right? Fear not, that's predicated on trust. You trust, therefore you don't fear. And you now can use your faith for what it's meant for, a vertical reach instead of a horizontal grasping, you know, in fear. Right? So that to start to think of yourself in this three-dimensional picture and start to use faith in a genuine way. You start with nothing but faith, but you want to mature that faith into trust. So instead of it being, when the revelators talk about the two, instead of it being in the order trust and faith, it can be faith and trust. So the trust is the foundational one. Right? That's what you're striving for. Now, and until you make that transition, you haven't gotten from the third epical revelation to the fourth. If you look at the description of the third, it tells you he is trying to get him to have a foundation of faith, maturing that first initial faith into trust. It's called trust and faith, the way they list it. Then other places, they flip it around. So like if you're going to try to do that love and service thing of the fourth epical revelation, that's supposed to be predicated on trust. But then I have an active faith that's reaching up from that trust foundation. It's standing on trust that love and service can manifest. If you're still grasping, you know, on the plane with your faith instead of standing on trust, you actually can't genuinely love and serve. I mean, it's too much about you and your terror of death and stuff, to love and serve. Right? So, you know, again, see, I mean, if you're still in the mode of trust and faith, then you haven't done step one that Jesus told you, the fear not step. You got to get it turned around to faith and trust so that you can now love and serve. And then upon that foundation, you can get to the fifth epic of Revelation and start thinking about all this philosophic stuff. Okay. And the other thing between the lines of that, designed to cultivate their faith, remember, especially on the first mansion world, why you'd want to take those individuals to the finality world and give them this visualization is because a bunch of those people on the first mansion world are going to lose their faith. They're going to have a crisis of faith. They're going to go astray, and they're going to go to iniquity. I mean, it's easier for someone on the first mansion world to do it than for Lucifer to do it. And if Lucifer can do it, certainly someone on the first mansion world can do it. Right?
No personality.
I mean, you know, remember, you take an adjuster out of a Gerasim citizen and make him one of the staff of a planetary prince, and they can still go to iniquity. That's not even on the mansion world. That's a Gerasim citizen, made it through all seven mansion worlds. As a Gerasim citizen, I mean, you are so beyond anything that you saw Jesus do during his private ministry. I mean, you know, Jesus didn't have mode of consciousness, you know, like during his Mediterranean tour. I mean, he was just a third circler. That's all he was on his Mediterranean tour. And he did all these incredible things, you know, relating to people and helping people. I mean, you are so far beyond that. You are so in advance of that. You are so much more personal and incredible in what you can do as a Gerasim citizen. And we'll read about that a little bit, just how profound some of the things you do are. And you take that adjuster away from Nod, say, and he goes to iniquity. Right? If Nod can do it, if Lucifer can do it, not only can someone on the first mansion world, I mean, even someone that's a Gerasim citizen and not fused yet can do it.
But he was led.
Sure he was, but that's the whole point.
They're not leading us anymore in that direction.
That's how people go to iniquity because, in general, because they're led there. They're not sophistry proof. I mean, Lucifer starts it, and he leads everyone else. He led Satan and everyone else, and Caligastia and everyone else over the cliff. All right. So all these things in place, they just remember, they need to try to get you to not be so focused on yourself. Try to get you to, see, notice how they say it. Faith in the ultimate destiny of transition. They're trying to get you to set your sights far afield instead of at your belly button. Because as soon as you start staring at your belly button, and it's all about you and your spiritual experiences or whatever, you're just going to ball up into an iniquitous blob over time. You've got to keep your head up. You know, it's not about you. You're not the most important thing. Keep your sights set to the horizon.
And you can do that now.
Yeah, and you can do that right now. That's why, that was Lucifer's problem. He stopped looking to the horizon. He started looking at his navel, and it just balls up into something that you don't want to be. All right. We've belabored this, a bit, but enable you to momentarily to glimpse. Remember how it got harder and harder for the master physical controllers and stuff to visualize, the ever higher Morantia form of Jesus, make him physically visible. Yeah, I mean, think about how hard it is for them to visualize finaliters to these individuals. So, they just give you a little flash. It's like, no one blink. Poof, there it was. Okay. That's all I can do. And the power beings are... All right, it takes great effort for them to bridge that huge gap between what you can see, and what they are. They've got to fill in that whole divide some way, see? All right. Let's see. Okay, and then just that final thing. All Mansion World Sojourners go to the finality word at least once a year. Again, just think about that. If they did it less frequently than that, there would be this sudden uptick in those going to iniquity.
That must be there's a lot of seraphim taken off.
Yeah.
I mean, and they go for an assembly.
Constantly, right. Yeah. Right. Like we said, if you could see even the seraphic, transport seraphic activity on this planet, you know, it's just nonstop. I mean, so when you go to these places, it must be just amazing. The frenetic activity of the transport angels is going to be mind-boggling. I mean, they're just firing them off constantly. it must be amazing. All right. So that's, you know, see, by and large, you see the rest of the list, and they're all kind of just little snippets. You know, that's the biggie. And look at how amazing that is, the symmetry of that. The very first place you are in the, you know, beyond this earth is tended by what you will be when all is said and done of the ascension scheme. Look at the beauty of that, how it comes all full circle. You know, and so when you finally achieve this great ascension goal, you come back to minister to those that are just starting on that ascension. You do a million other things too, but some of them come back.
Maybe from another super universe.
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, very likely. Yeah, a different super universe. Yeah. All right.
Two, the Marantia world. This planet is the headquarters of the supervisors of Marantia life and is surrounded by the seven spheres whereon the Marantia chiefs train their associates and helpers, both Marantia beings and ascending mortals. Let me read the next one.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
In passing through the seven mansion worlds, you will also progress through these cultural and social spheres of increasing Marantia contact. When you advance from the first to the second mansion world, you will become eligible for a visitor's permit to transitional headquarters number two, the Marantia world, and so on. And when present on any one of these six cultural spheres, you may, on invitation, become a visitor and observer on any of the seven surrounding worlds of associated group activities.
Okay, now your misread is perfect.
I thought
it was kind of cool. Right, see, look at, you know, I was saying, we were just about to talk about this issue. Look at the contrast. Your spiritual consciousness wants to say welcome. It's exactly the point I was going to make. And see, no, it's not like that. There are laws. There are issues.
But maybe both.
Right? I mean, obviously, you're quote unquote, well, but not just, you know, it's not an issue of, cause, you know, I'm going to go there because I want to, and, you know, who cares what the laws are, what the facts are. You can't go somewhere until it's time, until you're ready to assimilate that. If they gave you certain experiences when you shouldn't have them, it would disrupt your growth. Or at the very least, if you tried to go experience something too soon, you wouldn't experience anything because you don't have the senses to, you know, relate to it. You know, at the very least, it's that. Right? But especially at this early stage, you know, you're a very immature, fragile phenomenon. You can still go to iniquity. There's a fragility there, right? Fragileness there. Right. So, you know, it's a little bit mysterious about what exactly happens on each of these. Why is number two the Marantia world? You know, okay. We don't. You know, it's pretty hard to unpack the pattern of this yet. But, notice that. You can begin to reflect on it because when you're on the second mansion world, you become eligible for a visitor's permit to transition world number two. And so something about what you're doing on the second mansion world is catalyzed, helped by these experiences that are in some way kind of fundamentally Maurantia-like. It's just called the Maurantia world. We don't know exactly what to make of that. But it, you know, your first thought, oh, well, okay, in the first mansion world, yeah, I'm going to be quite material-like still. But you don't stay so material-like very long. On the second mansion world, they're already trying to really get you going into more of a Maurantia nature. You know? In other words, it's much more likely that you're going to be able to get to Moda consciousness. See, when you're on the second mansion world then on the first. You're probably still going to have such a limited consciousness on the first mansion world that you're going to need the tongue of Satania. You won't be able to consciousize the local universe tongue or the super universe tongue or anything like that. Too material yet.
Does say ascending worlds get trained there, though, so...
Right, and then and then they don't explain, you know, are these ascending mortals kind of at second mansion world level, or are these, you know, Gerasim citizens that are working there? It doesn't explain, so that's a little mysterious. But yeah, anyway, it is interesting to note that they're already pointing out that you start to help out with the activities that currently you can't even imagine. You start to mature early on and start to be a teacher instead of just a student.
That's the way we learn.
Right? And you start to play with the big boys. The Maurantia chiefs need helpers. Like, well, what do I know about Maurantia substance? Well, you will, you know, and he'll give you this job. All right. And unlike what we've seen some before, where if you get to the central world, you have access to all the subsatellites. Look at how there's gatekeepers here. I'm just stressing this because remember, you're at such an early stage that you go into a world where there's lots of gates still. As you ascend higher, the gates start to disappear. But at this early stage, just because you managed to make it to transition world number two doesn't mean you can hop over to one of the sub-satellites just at your own whim, right? You may, on invitation, become a visitor and observer only. Don't touch anything. Right? on any of the spheres surrounding the worlds of associated group activities.
Right?
See, just look at how... This is very rudimentary still. I mean, you're literally, you know, have to, there's signs, you know, please do not touch still, right? Because you don't know what you're doing yet. Okay, so little fun things like that. Just, we have to delight in these little details because, remember again, just like on constellation level, sort of directly what's going on here is completely beyond our imagination. notice they aren't really telling us anything about exactly what's going on, because they can't. But they're giving you these little statements to get you to reflect on sort of the truth of where you are. The truth is, you're very immature yet. You can only do things that are supervised. You have to have a chaperone everywhere you go. You know, it's just like when you're on senior trip in high school or something, you know, where there's chaperones, or at the dance, there's chaperones. You're still in that mode.
More like the kindergarten kids with a rope.
Yeah, the kindergarten kids with a rope, yes. Preschool kids,
billions,
yeah.
Billions of people.
Yeah.
Or beings.
Right. They're about to remind us that, you know, remember that the number of beings that are orchestrating all this is completely beyond our concept. Right, because there's so many ascending mortals just. I mean, you just start to think about how many beings it would take to manage all of this. You know, and there's just billions and billions and billions of mortals, you know, involved in all of this.
And it's only one ascension scheme.
Yeah.
Right, I mean, the six others are...
Yeah, not to mention the six other schemes that are going on at the same time with the ascension scheme here, yeah. But, you know, to John's point, just to try to wrap your mind around the logistics of managing the ascension scheme for countless billions of ascending mortals. I mean, right.
But Well, I guess my question is, are the six other schemes all happening on the system, in the system and the constellation parallel to us?
Yep, parallel to us. I mean, as soon as we get to the first mansion world, there's going to be stuff with the other six schemes going on there. You know, and so that's another reminder of how stark the limitations on the revelation are. They can't even tell you about the other six-sevenths of what's going on in the first mansion world. I mean, this is a very circumscribed revelation. Okay.
Number three, the angelic world. This is the headquarters of all the seraphic hosts engaged in system activities and is surrounded by the seven worlds of angelic training and instruction. These are the seraphic social spheres.
Okay, so all you've got there besides the fact that it's an angelic group of worlds, and so it's, you know, it's where the various angels hang out, is that seraphim need to socialize. Right? You know, they can't just go on indefinitely being your chaperone, for instance. You know, they need to let go of that sort of stuff for a while and just hang out with, you know, those of their kind for a while and chill out. You know?
Tent forward.
Right? Because it's, you know, just like you can't expect, you know, someone who works at a daycare center to do it 24/7, 365. They would go insane. No matter how much they love little children. Right? It's just, you know, it gives me too much. And it's like, can I be with adults for a little while? You know, or moms, you know, her home all day long, you know, and wondering what it would be like to talk to an adult again, right? not remembering how to say things in a way that's not baby talk, you know, or, you know, right. That's it. No, that's, right.
For the super angel world, this sphere is the Satania home of the brilliant evening stars, and a vast concourse of coordinate and near-coordinate beings. The seven satellites of this world are assigned to the seven major groups of these unnamed celestial beings.
See, so here's where you start to be reminded. You know, not only do you have the other six schemes that are completely unrevealed, you have no idea what kind of beings are involved in, you know, fostering, maintaining that those other six schemes, you know, but remember that, like when we were going through the universes of beings papers earlier in this part, there are just so many beings that are not even remotely hinted at in here, you know, and so, I mean, they can't even give you any suggestions about these seven major groups because, yeah, you know nothing. I mean, you've got one of trillions of different beings, you know, brilliant evening stars, that's all you know about. Right. So, but you can see there's a progression here that's kind of interesting. So you think about, you know, as you're ascending as a Marantia through the mansion worlds, and that whole bit about, well, how close am I to seraphim? Well, if I start moving up in cosmic nature, as I go from one mansion world to the next, there should be a point where I start to get kind of at the eye level of seraphim. Oh. There's going to be some effect to that when I'm on mansion world number three, because I'm parallel to the angelic worlds, see there. And then as I go to mansion world number four, I'm starting to kind of get at eye level with the, you know, the super angel stuff, the brilliant evening stars, and those sorts of kinds of beings that are a little bit more than seraphic nature, a little fancier, higher beings and seraphic types. See, so that's the pattern here. That's what you can read between the lines of this, is a little bit of a sense of how that's going. And like, let's say it's kind of typical for you to fuse on the fifth mansion world. You know, you look at what world is next here in parallel. See? That's what they want you to notice. Just think about that. Get a little sense of what kind of progress you're making
and
as you're going through.
These are 10-day journeys either.
Right. Yeah, you know, we'll be lucky if we can do the 10-day thing on the first mansion world, right? Right. Let alone any more than that. Yeah. All right.
Number five, the world of the suns. This planet is the headquarters of the divine sons of all orders, including the creature trinitized sons. The surrounding seven worlds are devoted to certain individual groupings of these divinely related sons.
So again, remember, there's all kinds of sons that haven't been revealed to. But that whole bit of when, you know, I think John's recognition was lighting up as I was just saying that. So that, you know, remember, at what point are you technically called an ascending son? When you fuse. Right? Right now you're just a face son. You know, you're a son in truth, not in fact. Okay? So, see, that's what, you know, you notice, oh, no wonder it's kind of the case that you got fusion for a lot when they're parallel to the worlds of the suns. See, that would be, you become a, in fact, a son yourself, an ascending son of God. So it all makes sense. Let's see, was there anything else there? Just, you know, including the creature trinitized sons. Remember that whole bit of trinitization that we studied and stuff. And so not only finaliters, but, you know, the trinitized sons that finaliters, say, have produced are also coming all the way back down here to the local system level and working. So you have an awful lot, just like you had Havona natives involved with the celestial artisans. You know, the central universe stuff and the Isle of Paradise stuff isn't all just there. Yeah. A lot of it is out here in the trenches. Okay, so little reminder that you can't bootstrap your way to paradise. You kind of it has to come to you, and you sort of use it as steps to walk up to get there. It comes down in a ladder extended down, this ministry, and you climb up that ladder. All right.
Number six, yeah. The world of the spirit. This sphere serves as a system rendezvous of the high personalities of the infinite spirit. Its seven surrounding satellites are assigned to individual groups of these diverse orders. But on transitional world number six, there is no representation of the spirit. Neither is such a presence to be observed on the system capitals. The divine minister of Salvington is everywhere in Nebadon.
Right, so everywhere. So that ubiquity, you know, that's the kind of everywhere we're talking about, not omnipresence, but the kind of everywhere that's called ubiquity. So when they talk about the world of the spirit, you know, they say they wanted to throw that in. Oh, ubiquity is everywhere from within. I'm within the finite, and I spread myself out everywhere. As opposed to I'm transcendent of the finite. I can't be down in the finite at all. But from a transcendent perspective, I touch every part of the finite from above. I'm omnipresent. Okay.
Sounds like the bumper sticker, a woman's face
is everywhere. Yes. because it's natural. They wanted to throw that in. You know, when they call it the world of the spirit, they didn't want you to think, you know, this ubiquitous spirit presence. We're talking about the, you know, individual beings. So they had to throw that in. But here's where you see it. Remember, this is where it really gets to be extreme. When you start to talk about all these high personalities of the infinite spirit, they told you way back, you know, previous paper, that even the number of categories of these beings is completely beyond your numerical concept, right? So you're getting way up in, you know, beyond the revelation now in terms of what's going on. You notice they don't even give you an example. You know, they gave you brilliant evening stars as an example for one of them. You know, here it's just, by and large, this is so beyond anything that the revelation is even touching on. But when you're on Mansion World Number 6, you're getting to be somehow in some parallel synchrony with such high things that are not even revealed in the fifth epical revelation. See, you're getting up there. Some significant things are starting to happen, you know, in your nature. And you're not a Gerasim citizen yet. You're just on the sixth mansion world. See, so like I was saying, to get to Gerasim means you're at eye levels of some very high things. So how sad is it to get up at such a high level you know, and then to join the rebellion, like Nod. I mean, think of the pain in those on high to watch that happen. How sad that is. To be functioning at such a high level and throw it all away because you delight in yourself more than the cosmos. You found your navel lint more fascinating than the horizon.
You got bedazzled.
Right?
But it only happens, or didn't happen very often.
No, but see, it's possible. So don't underestimate how much you could love yourself. Right? How dangerous it is to even go close to such a thought. That now, first thing I got to do is I got to love myself. Wait a minute, that's what all these psychologists tell me is first step. Yeah, how problematic is that?
No kidding. Well, it's semantic.
I know it is, but
I mean,
they aren't literally thinking in Luciferian love yourself. But see, how are those religionists who are unwitting secularists? You know, how did they get that way? Unwittingly. The problem is the unwittingness of this. You know, it's all innocent until people start to die.
Subtle.
Right? It's a subtle thing. It's why Jesus was so aggressive on that. If he even saw anyone hinting and going above self-respect, you start to go up a notch to self-esteem, and it's getting very dicey. It's just a hop, skip, and a jump. It's hop, skip, and a jump to take it up to the sixth level of meaning, to self-love. You're playing with fire, you know. See, so it's like, well, that's not what they mean by esteem in the self-esteem movement. It doesn't matter if that's what they mean or not. They use the word. The word is part of your cosmic recognition. Unwittingly, you will start to move up from the fourth to the fifth level of meaning in this love of self. And things start to go poorly, right? John the Apostle had a tendency to take it up to self-esteem from self-respect, you know? And so what did he say? I'm the apostle that Jesus loved, okay? He was childish enough and died soon enough that it didn't go very far. You know, he lived to over 100, but that's soon enough. They didn't go very far. But if he'd lived for 500 years, that could start to snowball into a big problem, you know? And someone would have needed to have been trying to pull him down out of that self-aggrandizement mode he was getting into.
Pride.
Right? Pride goeth before a fall.
Well, I find that a lot of that, you know, comes from not being loved. And so, which is one of the problems of today's society, whatever. I mean, and not being necessarily picked up and loved and understood and everything. So
yeah.
It's hard, you know. But when you have that, you have a depth of security versus without that. You know, when you never feel like you were loved, it's, you know, to love yourself is sort of like a way to be able to get that thing that I never got.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Right. And so, what's the power of the fifth epical revelation to cure that problem?
Well, for me, it's the fact that, you know, the greatest thing for me is the fact that there is a part of God living within me that loves me no matter what. And therefore, and to try and identify, to try and find that part of God within me, you know, try and, well, you know, it's hard to identify him all the time, but to try and be open to realizing that it's God, you know, that's living there. And so what are my highest thoughts and so on and so forth? How can I recognize that in myself?
Right.
And then bring that out in terms of loving other people.
Right. So you start with that anchor. I mean, you have to start within. So you have that wonderful addition to our understanding of our nature in the fifth epical revelation, that there's a fragment of the Father, literally within your mind. He loves you as if you're the only being in the universe. He's right there intimately in your inner life. And that gets you an initial foothold. But now you can, once you have that starting point, address the elephant in the room. What got you started in this insecure mode? We're very material oriented.
A lot of whoopings for me.
Right. That's what I'm getting at. We're very materially oriented. We are looking, there's no one in the external world that loves me. I mean, that's what got us started on this. You know, we're looking in the external world for love and not finding it.
But when you're young, now, it's somewhat natural, right?
Right, right. As I'm saying, it's all natural. This is like, nothing else can happen but this. And so how important is the fifth epical revelation? It goes beyond just the revelation of the adjuster. It's trying to get you to recognize that just as definitively as that table is in front of me, there are countless beings in the external world that I can't see. I can't see my adjuster either. So it's no more difficult to know that you can't even count the number of beings in your outer life that are loving you right now. You can't even count the number of categories of beings in the external world that are loving you right now.
You can trust.
Right? Know that. Know that they are there. Right? And to be able to take that leap, you know, it begins with that inner. Because you can, even though you can't see the adjuster, you might be able to sort of superconsciously sense an anchor, a stabilizing influence there that will give you some proof that you aren't just whistling past the graveyard. You aren't just fantasizing that you're being loved by countless number of beings. That can get you started, give you an anchor. I am touched. I am loved. Now I have to know beyond any shadow of a doubt that even if there's no blobs of protoplasm that love me, there are countless celestial beings everywhere around me that dedicate every waking moment of their life, and they don't sleep, to loving me. I mean, there is nothing farther than the truth to come to the conclusion that you're not loved and therefore you should just commit suicide.
Now, another thing
it
I
is
find
so
out
untrue.
True is that love is it's a funny paradox. It's one of those things that you only get to keep what you give away. The act of really feeling love is in loving. You know, it's a funny thing, you know. Right.
Because everything is encircuited. Everything is a flow. It's a universe of motion. See? Everything is a flow. Become part of that flow. And it starts with knowing that there's something out there. You know, when no one loves you out there, you quickly conclude that it's devoid of value out there. And so any potential for something to flow through you and out is illogical. Yeah. It seems like the wire has been cut. Right? But if you know that there is something that it can go to once it gets into you and goes through you, right? Again, like you're trying to develop a religion of the spirit. That's not an inner life religion. Right? If you think that religion is fundamentally about the inner life, you only have come to understand the religion of the mind. That thing in the Urantia book that they're telling you to try to challenge yourself to go beyond. Okay? There are two substances in the external world, in the outer life, matter and spirit substance. A religion of the spirit is an objective religion. A religion that's based on that spirit substance that's in the external world, it's not in your mind. That's what Jesus was trying to get us to develop. A religion that was predicated on the literal substance that you cannot see, that's objective. Anything that's in your mind, no matter how spiritual it might be, is subjective.
Though they say the mind's the gateway to it.
Right.
You have to use
it. Right. Only way that I can possibly know that there could be spirit in its substance in the external world is because I sense in the inner life that there's something above and more unity-like than just my mind. My mind, I can tell, is touching upon some other substance. There is a strength that I get in my inner life when I relate, when I plant my feet on that relative to the quicksand of matter. So again, it's just like with the adjuster and the beings out there. The inner life experience gives you this first validation that you're not just imagining all of this, right? That it literally is the case that you can have an objective religion, a religion that's grounded on the literal properties of spirit substance. Those properties are called values. That's the properties of spirit substance. Values are not properties of your mind, even your spiritualized mind. They're properties of that substance that's in the external world. You need to get identified with that other substance in the external world, and then you will have your feet planted on stability. The religion of the spirit, an objective religion. That's what we're striving for. Because, and see, and again, just getting back to what we're talking about just a minute ago, how helpful would that be to prevent me from going into that navel-gazing mode? Okay? To literally get myself anchored out there. Yeah? Because if all I do is just create a fancier and fancier navel, a more and more spiritualized navel, it's going to be all the more enticing for me to want to stare at. Right? You got to avoid that introspection thing, no matter how much you might exalt introspection as some really, really fancy animal thing.
I got a 2-carat diamond on my navel.
Get, right? Get yourself anchored without. That's why Jesus was encouraging that. He's trying to help us to move away from the dangerous path. You know, and it doesn't matter how sincere or innocent you are, it's dangerous to make yourself more, make your inner life without any definitive outer life to balance it more and more aggrandized. Right? It's easier to fall in love with yourself. Think about how easy it is to fall in love with a mind that has an adjuster in it, that's producing all these incredible, fancy, spiritualized, mindful forms. Think about how you could spend your whole life just in your mind experiencing that.
See? In here don't, think about falling in love with themselves. I think, most people get to a point, well, maybe you do. But, I think that, most of the people I know, have got to a point where their humility is important to them.
Yep.
Service is important to them. Yep. And it's not so much about always, falling in love with themselves as it is trying to do the best they can for other people.
Right. You know there are those
maybe
who...
Maybe it's because we're into it.
Right. You know people who aren't going down that track.
Yeah, but
there's a lot of people that are, right? Yeah.
Very seductive, the living within and harboring that really attractive navel is much safer than getting out there.
Yeah.
And if you're living in fear, you're liable to just stay within because it's not safe out there.
It's a very difficult thing because it's so abstract.
Yeah.
You can experience fancy things in your mind. You can't, no matter how much you visualize it, you can't experience that spirit substances out there that you're supposed to be anchoring in. See, you have that's to genuinely use your faith grasp to reach up beyond your mind and hence out to that spirit substance. Mm-hmm. Yeah? That's using your faith grasp in the way you should be using it. Use it to begin to take a hold of that which you can't see. Anchor yourself out there. The stability that you want is not to be found long-term within. It's to be found without. Okay, let's see. I guess we just have number 7 to do here, yeah?
No,
you got something?
Belabor that some
more. Yeah, let's belabor it some more. Okay.
What is the term moral value?
Not here, but just in general?
Well, related to that.
Okay, moral values. Okay, value is the foundation word, and then you're augmenting that. So just it fundamentally, just by the structure of the expression, is something that you're getting from the top down. You start with values, and the top down builds something upon it. The spiritual level is the 6th level of meaning. The moral level is the 5th level of meaning. Approach the 5th level of meaning, moral discrimination, from the top down, as opposed from the bottom up. So, just without getting anything specific, just structurally, that would be fundamentally what that expression implies. It's something that begins with value and then begins to build upon that. And when you do, when you start to do it that way, you start to really recognize that things and values are side by side, rather than initially thinking from the bottom up where you think there's things and then I go up to meanings and then I go up to values. Once you get to the top, you see it in a different way. You discover that things and values are side by side and meanings are a super additive consequence. And so that moral can be this super additive thing that it never could be before. Something that transcends values.
And the spirit that drives you, you know, think of it that way, has a moral code to it, or whatever you want to call it. And, you know, that obviously grows. I mean, as you grow, it's hard to, as they say in the book, judge others' morals. You know, it's hard to, you know, really tell, but I mean, they do grow. And so I think it's...
And the most difficult thing about judging other people's morals is the word moral. No one on the planet actually knows what the word means.
Nor do they know much about what the spirit means.
Why do they not know what it means? Because, see, in order to get it genuinely, you've got to get up to the top first and then begin to experience it. I mean, remember, your moral duty is your duty to the cosmos. So first step is to get in relationship to the cosmos, to get into that super additive state. I mean, when we go the bottom up and say morality, what we initially mean by that is just conformity with the mores.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And no mores are morals. You know, not even the taboos of the mores. They're just mores. Okay? And so, I mean, the challenge here is great. I mean, again, I mean, we could just go on and on like this. I mean, moral values is something that no one in this room, including me, understands yet.
Especially you.
Right? Jeez. We just haven't gotten that far yet. I'm still struggling to try to figure out what moral means in distinction from mores. I mean, humans don't use the word morals all the time, but it's a synonym for mores. Whether or not you're conforming to some mores system. And that's not morals.
Human system. Though that still small voice does help you.
But why, right, right? But why is the word more similar to the word moral? Because mores are shadows of morals. They're your initial tenuous relationship to the truth of morals, but they're not the fact of morals. To try to get beyond the truth of morals that are in mores to the actual fact of morals, that's the challenge of the fifth epical revelation also. Okay. All right, let's do number seven here. Read a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. Only read two of them,
yeah, just start reading. I'll tell you to stop if you need to.
Number seven, the world of the Father. This is the silent sphere of the system. No group of beings is domiciled on it. The great temple of light occupies a central place, but no one can be discerned therein. All beings of all the system worlds are welcome as worshipers.
Just one little quick comment there. The whole bit about you can't see the spirit substance in the outer life and you're trying to establish a religion of the spirit. See, just as true there. You're trying to establish a relationship with that which you can't see.
Or you think there's something there but you can't see it?
Yeah. Well, there is. But but of course, you know, you're trying to reach all the way to the Father who's definitely not there. you know, it doesn't matter if it's the Father's temple. No one can be discerned therein. It's just the same thing we were just talking about. To have a hold of that which you can't see. There is something that you can take a hold of there, but it's not a substance that you can kick. Okay? It's not an icon. It's not a fancy cathedral or whatever.
It's a temple of light, though.
Yeah.
So this doesn't mean that if you go there with a friend, you're not going to be able to see each other?
No, you just won't see, you know, domiciles, as they're saying there. You know, you don't have to go through the suburbs in order to get to this or something, right? All right.
And we're welcome. We don't need a permit.
Well, now you've got to read some more.
The seven satellites surrounding the Father's world are variously utilized in the different systems. In Satania, they are now used as the detention spheres for the interned groups of the Lucifer Rebellion. The constellation capital, Edentia, has no analogous prison worlds. The few seraphim and cherubim who went over to the rebels in the Satania Rebellion have been long since confined on these isolation worlds of Jerusalem.
Well, on the one hand, that seems appropriate. On the other hand, it's like, okay, so I've got the Temple of Light, and then I've got dripping black oozy things all the way around it?
Exactly. That does seem odd.
Yeah.
As a sojourner on the seventh mansion world, you have access to the seventh transition world, the sphere of the Universal Father, and are also permitted to visit the Satania prison worlds surrounding this planet, whereon are now confined Lucifer and the majority of those personalities who followed him in rebellion against Michael. And this sad spectacle has been observable during these recent ages and will continue to serve as a solemn warning to all Nebadon until the Ancients of Days shall adjudicate the sin of Lucifer and his fallen associates who rejected the salvation proffered by Michael, their universe father.
I mean, this is just fascinating. I mean, okay, so see, you notice you can't go there until you get to the seventh mansion world. See, so, but that the important thing there is, how far are you right now from true worship? If you aren't even mature enough to genuinely worship until you get to the seventh mansion world. That's what that implies, see, between the lines. You can worship in truth here on the first mansion world, all the way through the sixth mansion, but to worship in fact, to actually have a genuine resonance thing going on, you have to have the maturity of the seventh mansion world before you're permitted to go there. I mean, and it's a permitted. Your worship there would be grotesque. It would be this big blob of ugliness in amongst the worshipers there. Until you see, because you aren't in fact beautiful in your worshiping until you're on the seventh mansion world. And then and only then can you go there and synchronize with the beauty that is that worship there. Before that, you would be a gigantic black rock thrown in the pond of the placid worship that's going on there.
Do you think people actually go to these prison worlds and take a look?
Not anymore. Remember, they tell you that they used to go there a lot, but you know, anymore, no.
Nobody
goes there. Yeah. But you did notice they took the gates down. If you're on the seventh mansion world, you can go to the Father's world. You don't have to get an extra permit to go to visit the prison world. They'll let you just go there freely. It's like, well, shouldn't that be the one that has the biggest permit on it? No, we're not interested in those who are not sophistry proof because they're not real. What did Gabriel say on Gerasim when Lucifer was holding forth? You know, Gabriel, Gabriel, why don't you stand forth and counteract this seductive sophistry that he's oozing upon all of the people on Gerasim?
We're not interested.
We're not interested in those who aren't sophistry proof because they're not real. You, on your own, have to stand and face that. And if you can't, well, that's just eventuating something, you know, that would come to fruition eventually anyway. little reminder, you need to build up this inner strength because they expect you to face these things on your own. You have to stand on your own. Courageous and independent cosmic thinking. Nod didn't have it. Okay?
Do we know that Nod didn't, he rejected salvation proffered by Michael?
Well, remember, that has been adjudicated. Their adjusters are still hanging around, the prince's staff that joined the rebellion. Everyone expects that those guys will eventually be, eliminated. But remember, you know, it's like, well, they died and everything, didn't, you know, why would they have to be eliminated, you know? No, remember, they have a full-on Marantia body, a Gerasim citizen Marantia body that is in suspended animation somewhere. You know, and the adjudication would be for the power beings and the Marantia power supervisors to go in and unravel those Marantia forms.
So even these guys, you know, Michael offered them, you know, mercy. Why would somebody be that dumb?
I know.
Even if it was rehab for quite a while.
Oh, and by the way, you know, just you just mentioned something. Little detail. When you see them using the word proffered instead of offered, mm-hmm. What's the difference? Mm-hmm. The word proffered, or proffer is used when you want to very definitively distinguish between offering something tangible and offering something intangible. You know, he didn't offer him trinkets.
Right.
See? So it's a proffered rather than an offered. That's the way you're supposed to precisely use those two words. And the revelators do that. You know, when it's not something, you know, literal, tangible, that's, you know, that's being handed, you know, which would be offered. It's proffered. Okay. Just, you know, we'll wrap it up here. But a fascinating little thing, that because of the rebellion in this local system, you've got a phenomenon of this stark contrast in our local system. If you've got the temple of light that they have on the Father's, you know, world in every local system, but around ours is the contrast, the stark contrast.
Right now.
Yeah, until they finally adjudication.
Before the rebellion.
Before the rebellion, it wasn't like that. We don't know what the heck those worlds were used for before the rebellion. Just like eventually the mansion worlds won't be used for mansion worlds when there's no ascenders going into them. They'll be repurposed for something else. But when all is said and done, you know how we all kind of ridicule primitive religionists that still kind of hold on to that Old Testament thing about the fear of the Lord. Mm-hmm. You know, that's their idea of God. It's all predicated on fear. Wow, aren't they primitive? Look at this. Right? You know, read that last paragraph again to yourself. Look at how it's... If that doesn't put the fear of God into you to go to those prison worlds, nothing will. Look at how it's there. Very interesting. It's not animal origin fear, obviously, but they're trying to get you sobered. Can you get sobered enough so that if you go on to Gerasim citizenship, you don't do what Nod did? For Pete's sake, Nod, what on earth were you thinking? Right? If only Nod had prison worlds around the Father's world, maybe he would have focused himself enough. He was still too unfocused. He wasn't focused enough without his adjuster helping him to focus. Took the adjuster away. He couldn't hold his focus definitively enough, and he fuzzed out, and off he went. If he'd had the focusing, the fear of the Lord thing of those prison worlds, that might have kept his focus. Because what do? When you master yourself, fear becomes focus. What? They're just showing you that on high there's focus and focusing. You step it down to animals, and it's a thing called fear. That's why fear exists, because focus exists on high. Fear is a downstepped expression of focus. So you can follow it back up. Take that fear back. Take that fear back up and use it as your focusing mechanism. Use it as a tension step. Nod needed a hit upside the head with a sledgehammer. That boy needed an attention step. I mean, he was stuck on stupid.
He made a poor choice.
Yeah. So, just notice it's all there. It's kind of fascinating just to reflect on what's between the lines in these statements here.
So when they say the majority are interned, I guess they're referencing the few that...
There are still on the worlds, like Caligashia and Dalagashia, you know, and stuff. They're still on the worlds. No one on the local system headquarters is still running amok. You know, not even Satan anymore.
So it wouldn't refer to the ones that took the offer, proffer?
Oh, yeah, so the ones who were... I don't know.
Well, I mean, it's just...
The ones who did, in this context, it's the ones that are still on the sphere.
Right. I mean, you know, that just, you know, not everyone has been rounded up yet.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Caligashia and Dalagashia and Abaddon, and, you know, and all the others, you know, like are on our world, and all the ones on the other, you know, worlds. Okay. All right, let's take a moment and let's focus on the central world of those seven rather than the prison world. How about that for a moment here?